My neighbors were in severe trauma from watching me get beat up and kidnapped. I don't know if anybody out there that's listening to this or you've actually seen a big building burn. It is very traumatic. They watched their dreams burn up in flames. It became a very sinister shit match.
Welcome to a new season of Fenton Lives With. My name is Fenton. This is a podcast about me and the people that I live with. And let's begin with a conversation with my friend Willow, who I visited with my friend Ella in Topeka, Mexico, just this past February. Willow is an artist and storyteller who I met in 2019 when I was looking to visit Costa Rica. Willow built and ran an incredible art residency program in Costa Rica for many years until the residency was burnt to the ground by the neighbors. Willow is now developing a film that unravels this story, and it weaves together many other layers. It looks at shadow, recovering from trauma, and the impacts of repression and homophobia caused by years of colonialism and religious oppression in Costa Rica. This is an intense, in-depth conversation, and we cover a lot in 45 minutes. So relax, sip some coffee or mezcal, and open your mind. How about we just sort of introduce the space where, just sort of describe the place we're at. It's a very unique place that we've arrived to.
I'm in Topeka, Mexico, in the state of Nayarit. It's the land of the Wiriki people, or the Huicholes. I am about 40 minutes from the beach, and Topeka is an old sugar, tobacco, industrial town. It's off completely off the tourist map, but it has a beautiful old town, and it's so affordable in Mexico. So as a digital nomad artist, exiled, living in exile, I knew of this place from years ago because people would pass through here on the way to Guadalajara. So I looked up online and found a place here, you know, that's really, really affordable. I think it's a great place for a serious artist to isolate and not have to spend a ton of money. I'm reasonably close. If I want to jump up to Guadalajara, it's not horrible. Or do a shimmy shimmy down in Vallarta, it's kind of close. The weather's great. We saw yesterday, I mean, the markets are adorable. I mean, there's a really good market. And I think there's a freshness to a town like this because they don't have the inundation of the tourists and the sort of displaced gringo energy. So it's a little bit calmer and smileier and welcoming. So it's easy for me, and I don't feel harassed when I walk out on the streets of people trying to sell me things like, hey, gringo, you know. So that's been really good. And the place we're at actually in the house is, I would say it's more like a personal independent artist in residence. It's astonishing. I've always liked Mexican designed homes that they're deceitful from the outside because they just look like this wall. But many traditional houses always have the courtyards, right? And so that's what enables me to stay here, is I at least, the very least, can be outside in my house. So that's kind of fun. And I have great landlords here that gave me a box of weed a week after I moved in, of a plant that I had planted. So they're all just like these really cute symbols of things. You know, I have papayas growing right now. I have flax growing, tomatoes, sunflowers. You know, it's just a testimony to, it's a different way of traveling, I think, as an artist. And, you know, the infamous digital nomad is where you can actually care for a place. So that's been really nurturing to my process, is arriving as sort of a alien extraction to an environment, like not really a part of it. You know, like just even when I look at this little garden in front of us, it's a time capsule for me. Like I can see time moving. I mean, everything was seed. I put it in the ground and I see the sunflowers about 4 feet tall. They're blooming. And, you know, I was kind of sad the other day. I was like, oh, they're already blooming. But I was like, oh, well, now they'll turn to seed and the birds will come and different things. So it's a beautiful way for me to understand the movements of time. It's also a house that has enabled me as an artist to, you know, so much of my art has, you know, lived in chaos. And as an artist, we need bodies of work. It's a time-consuming project. And, you know, finding places that you can have a studio temporarily, move into a warehouse, is just, it's cumbersome for me. You know, the process of getting in and finding people that you could, you know, find a space. And this space is a miracle. I mean, I'm currently painting a large body of work, 24 paintings to work on fundraising for the film, Cries of a Jaguar. And I pushed the edges here to make bigger works. Like, I'm looking at the biggest work right now, which is probably 6 feet by 9 feet square. And then I have probably 3 or 4 more that are 6 feet or 9 feet by 3 feet. There isn't a single place I could do that as an artist. And I think that's something I'm constantly aware of. It was something I was aware of in Costa Rica my whole life. There are not enough places for artists to do their work at an affordable place. And to have the flexibility and the freedom to do it. Like, I can smoke weed here. Nobody cares. I can drink. I can play Madonna all night long loud, and it's not invasive to the neighbors or intrusive. So there's something like this. And, you know, I've just been thinking a lot. I was like, well, wow, I don't want to exploit this town. However, I feel for serious artists, it's a beautiful place to come. I mean, we saw old buildings that are for sale and rent downtown that are dilapidated. And I thought, oh, you know, this is a way people can regenerate, rejuvenate, and help, not become an extractive tourist. The house is beautiful. I mean, I literally have 4 rooms of paintings. And, you know, so I go from painting to painting to painting. You know, like, I'll do one room 1 week, take a day off, do another room another week. You know, when you're in a state of recovery, even from trauma or any situation, you know, having an ability to actually be still with your art, with yourself, is amazing in this world. I've pretty much been on the road the past 2 years. Oftentimes, like, if I want to smoke weed, I have to sneak and, you know, open a window. That's not always comfortable, and I'm not a weed head, but I like my stuff. As far as, like, trying to actually work on physical art, it's been almost impossible. It's been easier in Mexico. People are a lot more flexible at some of these places. So when I was in Oaxaca, I was able to initiate 6 earlier paintings, a part of this body, but it didn't have the wall space. So these are the things that I'm experiencing here, and just the place I'm in right now has afforded me to save incredible amount of money. I mean, I was talking to a friend yesterday, and I'm deeply concerned about housing right now in the United States. I have found ways because I'm able to be more flexible, but I do not understand how people afford housing in the United States.
I mean, I can't. That's why I travel. It's cheaper almost to be on the move. But let's talk about that for a second, because the last time I saw you was in New York, and I've seen you in a lot of places. And so I sort of want to get more of, like, I met you in Costa Rica at the art residency you're running down there, and then have been working on this film with you in various states of development over the past couple years, you could say. Talk about that for a second. Like, you mentioned it briefly, you're doing these paintings to fundraise for the film. Tell me a bit more about that. And, like, your whole past year was going to film festivals and doing all the schmoozing, and I got a little taste of that as well, and it was interesting. But I think we talked about this a bit. It's like that world is, you know, it's difficult to form real connections in, and people are flaky and all of this stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, the exit path of Costa Rica, a large part of it was, well, how do we take our wounds and engage and develop a sort of medicine from it, that a tonic that we can take out to the public. So that became a film project. And it's notoriously difficult to actually take on a film project. I mean, I certainly got hexed by a lot of people like, oh, you'll never get this done. It's so hard, blah, 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 blah. It's going to be really hard to edit and all this. But the cool thing about me is I've been an artist my entire life. I've been a sculptor. I've been a writer. I've done theater. Art in general is not easy, and it requires a tremendous amount of discipline and consistent devotion. So yes, last year I came across workshops online to get information on how to develop different aspects of film production. So the earlier parts, like the pitching, the lookbooks, you know, if you're working on a documentary, do you need a script? Do you not need a script? All these different things. So right before I came to New York, I was lucky because I was staying in Oaxaca, and I did a series of, I don't know, maybe 10. I would say they're more talks than workshops through Big Apple Film Festival. So I started listening to inside industrial professionals that were really accessible and really cool. So at that point, I was hearing from people, they weren't selling anything, but they were also much more positive than other people in the film industry, like that were coming out of LA or students that had been imposed upon by the fear of trying to get a project out. These people were more supportive. They were more like, one thing you need to understand about a film is most of them are years to produce. We don't get that a lot. You know, we live in an instant coffee environment. And, you know, you were one of the people in UNDZ that were, you know, kind of cautioned me that, you know, this is going to take a while. And I was kind of frustrated, even me. And I was like, no, what do you mean? So then the biggest thing about, you know, painting and sculpting and stuff like that can be more isolating. Writing can be more isolating. And then the threads to move it out are a little bit more linear sometimes. But film is definitely community on different levels. You are invited to explore networking. I mean, that's huge. And as someone who's a creative introvert, it was terrifying for me, but I knew that if I could go to these film festivals, and I chose them very carefully. You know, Big Apple was the first one we went to, and then I went to Tribeca, and then I went to a queer film festival in LA called Outfest, and then I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico Film Festival, and each one of those were so liberating to me about the process of producing a film. Yes, there are the egomanias, but that's in every job you have, whether it's corporate advertising or publishing or even waiting tables. There's always going to be something like that. So you can diffuse it by, you know, holding your own. So what it did for me this last year was really helped me to build my stamina in this type of project, to learn how to talk to people, learn how to listen, learn how to do it, not learn how to not do it and, you know, become afraid or think that you need to, you know, fuck somebody from Netflix in order to get published. There are so many ways to get a film out. So
can we just pause for a second? Just give maybe like the 30-second spiel on what the film is, because I realize we didn't do that. Like, yeah, what is this film trying to do?
Wow. Okay, so the film is Cries of a Jaguar, and it's a supernatural crime-sequenced documentary. It has tones of magical realism and what they call new wave or new age fablism. So it's a story with an anecdote, and it follows more, you know, which is rare for documentaries, but it has characterizations that are a little fairy tale-ish. So it's an experimental film. blossomed out of two things. One, of horrible crimes in Costa Rica that were surprising in a place that is featured as a star child. And then also as a testimony to hope of regenerative cultural, social, and ecological projects. And then it's the story, along with lots of conversations with locals and conversations with professionals, like the psychology of, you know, drug war, of internalized homophobia. So it addresses a lot of different issues. It has a doppelganger, which is interesting, a sort of drag wizardly persona. There are marionettes, there are vector animations. So in general, it's an experimental film project that could lend itself to episodic release. It's definitely 100% an indie film. I mean, where it's at right now is, I would say 80% of the footage is probably captured. There are some narrative sequences that need to be shot, and if there's any follow-up post-trial stuff in Costa Rica. So, I mean, the trick is on the film, so I've given you, I could go more into the story, but I'm wearing the hats, and you see this if you look carefully at different indie films or documentaries, or even Maestro with Bradley Cooper. I mean, he wrote, directed, and produced it. So my thing is, when people start to hex me and say, you know, you can't do this, I'm like, look, you can do this. It's more work. I said, why not lean into the challenge as opposed to being repulsed by your own projects? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what I, you know, look into. So
I think we were talking about this earlier, like one of the challenges was like you putting more of your voice into it, because we went and did, so some background, we went and did interviews with a bunch of Costa Ricans about living in Costa Rica and sort of the challenges there and the violence and the court system and all of that stuff that you were talking about. And a lot of this is centered around your personal experience of having run a residency, living in Costa Rica for over 10 years, and some of the crimes that you personally face. So I think, do you have any like reflection on that now? Like how you can put more of your voice into it, being the person who's also like directing it? And like, I think for me, that's just is difficult, because it's like you need someone almost to like, you know, be more impartial or whatnot. It's like hard for me to edit my own footage sometimes. I want to just pass it off to somebody if I'm making something super personal. So I'm curious like what your thoughts around that are.
Okay. That was a complex question. So the first thing I would address, which is interesting. Okay, yes, we did start out on a level that this would be sort of a interview sequenced narrative, like, you know, get the Costa Ricans more involved. What do they say about Puerto Vida and all these things? Then through my allies in this, they were like, well, we want to hear from you. And at first I was really shy because I didn't want the story to be about me. But then I was like, okay, maybe this does make more sense. So then the next evolution was as I went out and then started to watch more documentaries, there were two things that happened. One was like, I didn't just want this other, you know, interviewee style documentary. I was like, the market's saturated with that. And honestly, it doesn't interest me anymore. So I was like, okay, this is a subject that has been touched on. So how do I push it forward more? And yes, that was when maybe it was Gracie, I don't know which one of you had said, well, why don't you integrate your drag persona, you know, which is this Jaguarella character. And I was like, oh, well, that's really interesting, because we all kind of have a double persona. We have an internal voice and external voice. So those were things that started to help me relax into the storytelling, as opposed to like, it's just me, you know, a biopic, one perspective, like blah, 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 who wants to hear my story? So there were different techniques that started to get integrated. And the other thing that happened for me was, I don't know at what point, but at one point, I think I took the transcripts together from the interviews and maybe little vignettes that we had caught or maybe not yet, but I put together a script. And a lot of people would tell you that documentaries don't need a script. That's perhaps true. I beg to differ because it helped me so much to understand how to integrate my story in harmony with the conversations that were super potent, to actually pull more of them out, and not have it just be this dry interviewee sort of thing. So I really feel like, you know, putting together, you know, this sort of mock script was incredible. And I did read that book, you know, the Save the Cat thing. And I sat down and that helped me learn a lot about my voice in it, you know, how to do it so it's anecdotal. I looked at a lot to see how to integrate humor. And that's the doppelganger is able to sort of suck the intensity out of it a little bit, not make it into farce, but it allows a little sardonic humor. So those were the ways that I started to look how to, you know, integrate a complex narrative. And I know people say, well, you know, there's so many issues addressed in it, but I think what happens in our art these days is we oversimplify complex stories. And I think I'm one of these people, and it may create a more and more limited specific audience for this film at some point, but I think there are audiences that like complex layered stories, multidimensional characters. So that's where I'm leaning into, even as me, like I want, and you, we worked a lot together on the development of the early B-reel. And that's phenomenal. That is so phenomenal because that allows people to see this somewhat egotistical character, Willow, as a more multi-layered person. So somebody can lean into different aspects of me as opposed to, like, you know, some facade of a celebrity persona. Like, I want it to be all about me because I fought tooth and nail. I did not want it to be about me. And I don't want the focus, you know, when I was rereading it and the testimonies and stuff, you know, the crimes are very delicate to present because it's like either it's another crime story for Netflix, you know, blah, 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 or it's presenting the crimes as a part of the story, but not the central focus. So I'm pulling out, like, the medicine is okay, I think the celebration is how does anyone transform, you know, shadow, whether it's societal shadow, personal shadow. And I think that's the celebration of the film and my voice in it, because, you know, those are testimonies, because there's so many people going through hard things. You know, if I can watch that and somebody gets from it, like, oh, you know, if he got through kidnapping and beating and arsons and land rights and all these things and walked through it so eloquently to try to understand, not put the people that did it to him as just the perpetrators, but to go deeper into the roots of the psychology. People are not doing that. Like, well, why are people doing this?
And can you tell me about the kidnapping, just for people who may not have known your story and all the land rights stuff you were dealing with?
I mean, you know, to capsulize that, I think I would rather lead into that with the psychology. I think there are the episodes. I mean, there was a kidnapping. I had a lover that had so much psychology going on that just at a certain point exploded. And I think that is so easy for any of us to implode or explode at any moment, especially if people are taught to repress their feelings. And this is something I saw in Latin America. I mean, I see it here in Mexico. The passivity, the repressed societies that have just been mercilessly opposed upon by our very elaborate lifestyles in the United States and in Europe. Now, that's not pointing at North Americans as being wrong, but so the lead-in is, like, you know, when I look at this and I would look at, like, you know, the kidnapping and stuff. And even when it was like going on, I was like, what is causing this anger to be directed at me? Because I knew it's very important that it's not about me, like the whole land rights thing. It's not about me. I mean, I went in very innocently, not naive. I was like, okay, I think, yeah, we can start trusting each other. I can build on your land. I can help you. We were in agreement with the neighbors. They definitely wanted more arts and culture. So there were things like that. And I think there were two things that can happen. Like if I look at the catalyst as opposed to like what went wrong, I think that, you know, I would say like one of the instigators of the tryst, the turn of events, was a lover that I had that had severely depressed internalized homophobia. And that's a precursor, and you're starting to see that pop up actually in public conversations on social networks, but it's a really unexplored topic. It's when people are queer or gay and they loathe themselves, you know, and they hold it and they pack it down, and they could be outside the happiest, queerest people on the planet, but internally they hate themselves and they think they're bad or something. And there are times in life that those are either explored or vented or pushed out through addictions or illnesses or attacks on lovers. And so it was interesting. I mean, I was getting a workshop together with some friends, and I had talked to somebody about me, and I think my former lover, Frank, had touched what's called the angel realms. So one thing that I understood in Costa Rica, and more so there than in Mexico, because Mexico's proximity, the United States, they have a lot more overlap. But in the place I was in Costa Rica, and actually a lot of the country, you have people that have never left their country, almost never gone to nearby villages. And so there is a different level of exposure. So when people would come visit me, and like my lover, they would become exposed to things very quickly, like very hip things, okay? And we tend to think this is like a weird type of colonialism, that everybody can handle our hipness wherever we go. But we don't always understand the consequences, that people are really embedded in very old, traditional social spectrums. You know, like we were talking about the mother, and the one thing that started to happen, if you want like the psychology and the things that catalyzed, you know, the kidnapping, the land rights, was the effects of religion were tremendous in this. And so I have a lover that, you know, he was brutalized as a kid by religious oppression. And then he's also exposed to a wild aunt who's in a satanic cult in the mountains. And so those things explode, and then they explode. So the next catalyst is this momentum I had with the neighbors for years, which was reasonably positive, and we're together and we're doing this. The night of the kidnapping, the way they responded, my neighbors, was to hide in fear. One, they're afraid of the police. They don't call the police. And two, they were afraid there were guns involved. So the psychology was, you know, so I'm in it. I think what I went through was more textbook. I think it's more fascinating for me to try to decipher the best I can through conversations and reading and study what, you know, postured the people to do these things to themselves. So I realized probably within weeks that my neighbors were in severe trauma from watching me get beat up and kidnapped. Because, I mean, they heard me screaming and all these things. And then they isolate into severe shame, you know, because they're like, why did, you know, I don't know. I can't go into their heads, but I know one of my neighbors approached me like the day after the kidnapping and said, you know, we heard you. We just hid in the bushes. And I was horrified. I was like, you were in the bushes. He said, but we didn't know they had guns. And I'm like, well, why didn't you call the police? So there, then you start to realize, wow, you have a society that is broken.
And you are not in like a touristy part of Costa Rica, just to make that clear. Oh, you are in the cloud forest in the south.
Yeah.
Rancher, like, weren't your neighbors like in farming or ranching?
Yeah, they were in farming and ranching, and they were actually really cool, you know, on many, many levels, and probably levels of curandera and medicine man and interesting. But so there was that episode. Then I leave. And then 3 months later, I don't know who, what, why, when, or how, but there's an arson that burns the main building to the ground. And at this point, the neighbors respond. They go to the street. They try to manage the fire. People come up. But I realized, I knew also at that point, I don't know if anybody out there that's listening to this or you, you've actually seen a big building burn. It is, even if it's not yours and you're not involved, it is very traumatic. I mean, it's what we see even when we watch Gaza and we watch the Ukraine. It's so primal, volcanic. We have no control because fires move so fast. But I kept thinking, you know, when this was going on, when I had some time to digest it afterwards, you know, people were like, well, why did you go back to rebuild? And I was all, honestly, I mean, I'm not trying to be this hero, but I went back because I could get weepy. Is like, I felt so much for the neighbors. I'm like, they watched, I wasn't there, but they watched their dreams burn up in flames. And they somehow, I think like Jose and stuff, backed it up to their response to the kidnapping. And, you know, that they built with their hands, not some industrial construction company, not, you know, that they were there with every hammer, every dug every hole for every outhouse. And I think that was a trauma that, you know, is almost insurmountable, you know, to try to recover. So I went back, and I remember on my balcony in my house, the first thing I did within a couple of days is I called a meeting with my neighbors, and I said, the guys, you know, Mercedes and Alexis and the kids that all worked on it, I said, come up. And I just sat down with them in a circle on my balcony. I said, this must have been really hard for you. What do you have to say about it? Do you want to talk? Do you want to vent? Or whatever I said, but I wanted to invite them to talk about it. And it was interesting because once again, you see this repressed male, you know, the male that doesn't have any mode to express their vulnerability through emotion. And they would, I kind of just went around the circle and they were like, oh, we felt really bad for you and it was really bad. And I was like, and? And so then it was like, I was very aware at that point, it was like a bellwether. It was like everything had shifted in the psychology of me and the neighbors. Now, I was one person, so I was like, you know, this is a whole psychology that could involve therapists and deep healing. So I did what I could do, but I remember I thought the best thing I can do is to rebuild and show them we can do this together. We can come back and we can do better and we can protect each other. And we, you know, this, and there are amazing pictures in the footage of, you know, when I first went down to see the first burn site in 2018, and it is priceless to capture Mercedes' face. You know, like the sullen look, because we're trying to figure out how to rebuild and use the existing foundation. But at the same time, he's a maestro. That's the Spanish word for an expert, carpenter, that he's walking through the ashes of his building he built. I mean, I was the financier. I was the person that did all the la-la-la fluffing, the varnishing, the painting, the internal decorations, the getting the materials together for the kitchen and marketing, all these things. But the gist of the actual physical building. And I knew I would walk around and I'd be like, but they never had any means to unpack it. You know, then it becomes a weird psychology. And I think after I built and finished, there were just unruly energies from a couple of the neighbors' kids who had the land, where there was suddenly this push to get something from me, which had never really been there. All I remember is one day they came up and they were like, well, you need to get out of the house that I was living in, which was technically theirs. And the center, we're going to split up and we'll take the cabins and you can have the big house that we just rebuilt, the big main building, and the Hummingbird Tower. And I was devastated. I was like, no, this will just end the project. So there were just a lot of different things that went on. And I kept thinking, okay, there's got to be a way to win-win. And I think, you know, my whole gist of doing the project was I wanted to get enough momentum with financial recovery that I would share the profits and we would put everything together as a biorefugio in a foundation. I thought we were all on the same page, but one of the things that you discover, and this is more fast forwardy in the conflict, is that there's tremendous amount of fraud and fear over land in Latin America. And it surfaced in Costa Rica because a lot of people don't own the land. It's in very old agrarian law systems that make no sense. You're supposed to cultivate on the land. You can only build so many buildings and la, la, la. And then what happens is people start to sell a version of a title year after year after year. And so 30 years of that land that I was building on were people passing sort of illegit titleship. And so then it became sort of like a ego piss match. And then I'm in a situation where I'm like, there's a part of me not, I want to move away from being self-righteous, but I was like, I could see the future for them. And this is where I want to be careful being like the white boy with the flag, but I was invited to do this, is that I wanted to keep them from destroying their future. I was like, look, most of your kids are dropping out of school because they're bored. They have no right brain activities. So I kind of was like, okay, if I can figure out the land rights and just get title, we'll figure this out. So when I started hiring that attorney, that's when things got really confusing for me, because the you know, he tried to explain to me the land rights and the agrarian society, and then I invited in somebody else to help me. And then it became, which I found out more and more later, that it became a very sinister shit match. Like, it was really weird. Like, I don't know the subliminal energy, but people just sort of knowing or not knowing became people that wanted to get over on me, you know, like in one way or another, whether try to extort me for money or represent me legally and then walk away from the case. And then the neighbors to constantly harass me by sending immigration and all these things, you know, where I literally, if I still to this day, if I hear a certain type of truck or horn, I get freaked out, like the police are here. So I started to live things that we don't hear about, you know, the whole expat thing, which I don't like, but I was a legit immigrant to another country, of being severely harassed to be kicked out of the country. So, and then subsequently, fast forward to where we are today, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, during all these conflicts in court, I mean, I suppose right now there's probably 10 active cases. You know, this is where we see, and we, this happens to us everywhere. You know, you, oftentimes we will become our own worst nemesis. You know, there's like an innate destroyer in human essence. And I think the sooner we can deal with that in shadow, which the film hopefully will do, but these people, I don't think had any new age repertoire to deal with shadow and anger and fear So they resolved only to what was the easiest for them, which was severe machismo dominance, bullying. And the final, one of the final nails in the coffin of the place was they burnt the place down, the second building that was built. But they burn it down. And then they collectively became a very insular, secretive, deceptional person. Like, oh, well, we want over, you know, the gringo, you know, Willow, the only person. I mean, I'm not a savior complex person, but they, this last picture I saw this week of them dancing on the ashes, literally, and laughing with a new cabin they had built was, I think, the most horrific thing I had ever seen. I was like, all I could think of was the psychology is like, oh, these people, their indigenous roots, you know, they're all mestizo, so they're mixed. They have become the Spanish conquistadors. They have essentially built the church on the ruins of their hope and their ceremonial existence. And that's interesting. And that's something that, you know, I look at the film and I think by default right now, is I think, well, let's let this incubate because I don't think the story is complete. I want to allow this. We have the time now. I used to want to try to push it through, but I'm like, let's see how this plays out a little bit because there's some things. So I hope that answers some questions. I mean, I could go more into the specifics, but watch the film.
Yeah, that's a good teaser, I think. Thank you for that. I want to be conscious of our time because Ella and I do have to take off to Guadalajara, but I want to wrap it up somehow. Yeah. Oh, wow, perfect. My alarm was about to go off. I'll just bring it back to where you are now, like just to tell me what excites you about being here and I don't know, in the next few days or weeks or months, however you want to take that.
Well, okay. This is what I would put out to people. And I mentioned this last night. I said, in real life, day to day, I'm happy. I'm fine. You know, which is like really, really weird. I have no idea how to explain this. So you're saying what I'm excited about. I am 62 years old, and for the first time in years, I mean, I ran an artist in residency place in Costa Rica, developed it. I've always been doing art, doing paintings, writing books, making tarot cards. But I would say for, I don't know, at least 15 years as being a serious artist, this is the first time I've had this amount of time to devote really intensely to my fine art in a long time, like this level. So honestly, I wake up every day really excited to paint to this level, like this level of focus and intricacy, because this is art. This is the magnificent, brilliant side of making art, you know, where you're given the place, the time. I'm not worried about money. I'm not worried about lovers, attacks, nothing. And I can just dive into it every day. And that is so rare. So that's the immediacy. And I think the future is that, you know, putting this out to galleries and exhibitions, I think there's a lot of me that I know some film will happen. I know some level of restitution will happen in Costa Rica. There will be courts on the fraud and stuff. I don't know what that is, what that will look like. My objective is not to win. It's to show them themselves. I want them to have a chance to express into a court their lies. Otherwise, they're going to have to deal with some weird karma. They have to get it out. And to help themselves grow. So I'm reasonably excited to see how the money can come in, how the film can pull itself together. This is true indie, and it's not the new indie, you know, which, you know, you see, you know, movie stars moving into indie stuff like that. So I'm excited to see what happens this next level, absolutely. You know, if I can get some money and get some editing rolling, and to see the cases unfold, which will probably happen in, for sure in the next 2 or 3 years because of the statute of limitations. So I'm okay, you know. It's still, I mean, I want to let people know all this that I'm saying, but I want people to understand depression and PTSD is very real. And I definitely, it's hard for me to look at sometimes. But, you know, I was talking to, you know, your friend last night, and I was like, the thing about time and existence, reality, part of me doesn't even remember living there. I mean, I know I did, absolutely. I see the pictures, and it's not displacement, but my life has been so active and actually really fun. I mean, these things have been really cool. So I'm like, okay, I think they're more miserable than I am because they have to face their own darkness. So, yes.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again in the next place, probably New York, when you come and do your gallery show. It'll be very exciting. Yes, yeah.
Gotta find
another
place.
Okay. Yeah, gonna be a fun time. Thank you.
Will you give me these copies?
I will send this to you. Yes. Thanks, Will. Okay.
That was fun. You're always really, really good at that. You can pull
that. That's my skill.
I haven't thought of the whole, you know, recapitulation. Was that okay for you?
Yeah, no, I think it was a really good, like, yeah, overview on the film and everything.
Because you're involved, so.
It's so much. It's like, how do you distill that in 40 minutes, you know? But I think you nailed it. It's perfect.